All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this breakout, Exploring Ocean Solutions. Thank you all for joining us. Today, we are joined by Brad Ack, who is the Executive Director and Chief Innovation Officer at Ocean Visions, and by Sarah Guy, who is the Director of Strategy and Outreach at the Ocean Defense Initiative. This is a pretty tight 30-minute session, so I'll turn the floor over to our speakers, and I'll start with Sarah. Sarah, could you please tell us a bit about the Ocean Defense Initiative, your role there, and some of what you're focused on? And then when you're done, we'll ask Brad to do the same thing.
Sure. And thanks, Danny, and thanks for inviting me to talk about the ocean and climate mitigation, and to everyone for spending your weekend here today. Danny, I know you referenced reconciliation fatigue earlier today. I can confirm it is real. But it is so energizing to connect with such a big group of climate advocates, and I'm thrilled to know you're taking this energy to Capitol Hill. So my name is Sarah Guy, and I work with Ocean Defense Initiative, and we're focused on promoting ocean leadership in Congress and the administration and elevating the connection between the ocean and climate change. And we look to the ocean as a powerful source of climate solutions, not just as a victim of climate change. And we're working to drive that point home for leaders in Congress and the administration, because we know that ocean-based solutions can provide up to 20% of the emissions reductions we need to reach our climate goals here in the US and around the world. So we really focus on three areas of ocean climate action. And the first and most important is reducing emissions. So this is the most important thing we can do for the ocean, which is suffering from warming and acidification. And when it comes to the ocean, looking at those solutions include stopping the expansion of offshore drilling, first and foremost, but also promoting ocean-based renewable energy like wind and tidal, where we have a lot of work to do and a lot of catching up to do with some other parts of the world. And also looking at how we can decarbonize our ports and shipping sectors. And secondly, we are looking at protecting ocean and coastal ecosystems that are really good at storing carbon. So we call these blue carbon ecosystems. They include mangroves and salt marshes, seagrasses, and I think Brad will likely talk a little bit more about this. And lastly, we're just looking at increasing coastal and ocean resilience to climate change impacts that are already happening. So that's in areas like coastal restoration, sustainable fisheries management, marine protected areas, and reducing plastic pollution. These are all actions we can take to help the ocean, our coasts, marine life be more resilient to climate change. So there's a ton of work going on in all these areas all over the world. My work is really focused in the United States at the federal level. And I would say my job is a mix of coordinating across coalitions, developing communications materials for advocates to use, and working with staffers in Congress and the administration to encourage and support these kinds of ocean climate actions. So at Ocean Defense Initiative, over the past 3 years, we've kind of convened an informal coalition to advance ocean climate action. And I'm happy to say we're seeing progress. In the administration, we saw a lot of positive executive orders early last year, or this year rather. It feels like it's been more than 1 year, on climate, conservation, renewable energy. And to kind of follow up with that, we helped organize a letter this fall. We had 118 organizations and businesses sign on, asking the administration to develop and implement a comprehensive kind of whole of government approach to ocean climate action. 2 weeks after we sent that letter, the White House convened its first Ocean Policy Committee meeting, and they committed to doing just that. In Congress, we're also seeing positive developments, and we've supported legislation like the Ocean-Based Climate Solutions Act, which was kind of the first legislation of its kind that really comprehensively looked to the ocean as a source of climate solutions. And I know we'll talk a little bit more later on about the Build Back Better Act, but there's also a lot of positive content for the ocean and climate in there. So that's me and Ocean Defense Initiative. You can kick it to Brad.
Great, thank you, Sarah. Go ahead, Brad. Same question to you. What is your role at your organization, and what are you focusing on?
Sure, great. Well, hi everybody, and thanks for this chance to chat with you all a little bit. I am the executive director of an organization called Ocean Visions, which is a broad-based partnership between some of the leading oceanographic research and academic institutions in the United States, with a whole host of players in the public and private sector to basically advance workable solutions to some of the most critical challenges facing the oceans. We are very focused on new design, innovation, and new thinking about ways to confront the crisis in the oceans. I've been working in this space for 30 plus years and working on a range of marine issues, from fisheries to protected areas to plastics. But throughout that entire time, the one issue that has loomed ever larger as a threat to the health of the ocean has been the disruption of the climate. So the ocean crisis and the climate crisis are exactly the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin. And the ocean, as many of us are fond of saying, has absorbed most of the heat that we've trapped in the biosphere, the excess heat that we've trapped to date. And it's also taken the brunt of all of this direct deposition of carbon. What we don't often follow up and say is that that is actually destroying the ecological integrity and function of the oceans. So this heat that the oceans has taken up, that we sort of blithely refer to as 90% of all the heat, is equivalent to about five atomic bombs of heat energy, Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs of heat energy going into the ocean every second of every minute, every hour, every day for the last 25 years. That's the amount of heat we've been pouring in the ocean. And the 25 years before that, it was around the equivalent of four. So, and then we've also directly deposited about a third of all of our carbon pollution has gone right into the upper layer of the ocean, causing ocean acidification. So while we are completely on board with the need to decarbonize and to shift away from fossil fuels and carbon intensive conveniences, that's not going to be enough. It's not going to be enough. We actually already are past the point of atmospheric and oceanic concentrations of carbon that are dangerous for most of the living creatures in the ocean and dangerous for us. So we're working on the second part of the climate equation, which is reducing overall content of atmospheric carbon and oceanic carbon. So this is what we call carbon removal or carbon cleanup, right? So we've got a pollution problem. Sorry. I've got a little dog barking. We have a pollution problem where we're pouring too much carbon into the atmosphere and it's sitting there. So like any pollution problem, we not only have to turn off the tap, we have to clean up the mess. And what we're working on are a series of technologies and innovations that use the power of the ocean, the gigantic photosynthetic power of the ocean and the geological process of the ocean, to draw down carbon from the atmosphere and safely store it at the bottom of the sea. So you may remember some years ago, James Hansen, the chief scientist at NASA, said, if we exceed about 350 parts per million, you know, we're entering dangerous ground. We're at 411 parts per million, and the net zero by 2050 would put us at about 550 or 600 parts per million. That is completely unsafe for us and for the ocean. And so not only do we have to turn off the tap, we have to clean up the mess. And that's what we're focused on very intently at Ocean Visions.
Great. Thank you, Brad, for that introduction. And getting into some questions here that I have, and then we'll get into some questions from people on the line. And if you could put your questions in the chat, please, that'll be better than raising your hands. It'll be easier for us to look at those. So if you're in the audience, please put your questions in the chat. But right here at CCL, we've been focused on carbon pricing as a solution to climate change. And at this conference, we're starting to explore solutions in addition to carbon pricing that will help mitigate climate change. You've talked about cleaning up the mess. The ocean has been a huge part of mitigating how the climate, as you said, just how bad we feel it. But could you tell us a little bit more about the projects you're working on in the mitigation space?
Yeah, so, you know, the IPCC actually defines mitigation as including both stopping the flow and cleaning up the mess. So we're on that second part, which is cleaning up. And basically, we're working on technologies and inventions that build on the natural processes in the ocean. So there's a lot of talk about the Trillion Trees Initiative on land, right? Growing a lot of trees to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. You can do that more effectively, actually, in the ocean with less conflict over land use and with much faster growing plants that are micro and macro algae, right? So one of the pathways is around using large scale micro macro algae cultivation to suck carbon out of the environment. The ocean also naturally cycles carbon through geological processes by interacting seawater with alkaline materials such as limestone or olivine. And ultimately that chemical reaction leads to carbon being pulled out of the upper layer of the ocean and transformed into bicarbonate where it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. We're looking at a variety of different inventions that will accelerate that process. So much of what we're looking at is very new technology or new ways of applying older technologies in the interest of capturing massive quantities of carbon. And just to be clear, the IPCC has said in its multiple models and scenarios and the 1.5 report that it put out in 2017, I believe, that we will need to pull between 100 and 1,000 gigatons of carbon out of the atmosphere and safely store it somewhere in order to achieve the 1.5 target. Now, I would argue the 1.5 target is a dangerous goal. We should be looking to try to restore the climate to get back to below 350 parts per million. And if you accept that as a goal, we're going to have to double those numbers. And, you know, 100, a gigaton is a billion tons. So 100 gigatons, 100 billion tons, and 1,000 is a trillion tons. That's just what's called for to meet the 1.5 target. It's a massive, massive amount of waste that we've put into our biosphere that we have to clean up for future generations and for all the other life forms on the planet.
Yeah, thanks for that, Brad. I tend to agree with you. The way I've looked at this studying paleoclimate is the last time we were at 300 parts per million, sea level was substantially higher than, I think it was 6 meters higher than it was now. Maybe it's more. So that's unacceptable. So I tend to agree that we've taken our eye off the ball. But thank you for that. Sarah, are there policies in Build Back Better that address ocean priorities and that you're excited about?
Yes, definitely. And I'm so glad you guys are taking to the Hill to support the Build Back Better Act next week. I would say I'm most excited about the climate investments, $555 billion for clean energy and climate makes this the largest effort to combat the climate crisis in American history. And that is all good news for the ocean and will help reach our climate targets by cutting climate pollution immediately. So that's what I'm most excited about. Within that, there are several other categories related to the ocean and good provisions and good funding. One is a ban on new offshore drilling. This is in the House version, and we'll see if it makes it through the Senate, but kind of moving in the right direction as far as ocean-based energy, and also some language to allow for a policy change needed to help scale up offshore wind, which is a positive development. As far as funding, I would say there are two big categories related to ocean climate action in the Build Back Better Act. One is for coastal restoration projects. And I know Dr. Johnson touched on this in her remarks, but $6 billion in there for coastal and Great Lakes restoration and resilience, which is a big increase of what we've seen in the past and a win for leveraging climate mitigation potential of these ecosystems for coastal community resilience, for fish and wildlife habitat and restoration jobs. And we are also excited to see language in there representing an advancement for environmental justice, because there is no longer a matching requirement for these federal funds, which has historically been required and tends to disadvantage frontline communities who are both experiencing more severe impacts of climate change and also less able to raise matching funds. So with that requirement gone, there's more equitable access to this funding. And the other big category in there that we're excited about is ports and shipping investments. So this is funding for port electrification, investments in clean transportation. I think this will help create lower emission ports, which will improve air quality in the nearby port communities, increase climate mitigation in the sector, and again, just contribute to reaching our climate goals. So we are excited and hope to see things come together in these next few weeks. I feel like I've said it's the last push for a long time, but I hope it's real this time.
Well, as you said, I mean, reconciliation fatigue is real. So that was a great summary of what's in Build Back Better that you're excited about. I'll ask the flip side of that question now. Is there something that isn't in Build Back Better that you would like to see and think is really important?
So I think, it's such a massive bill, and these are small pieces. I think we need a more comprehensive vision of what we can do with the ocean, and also a lot more detail, just breaking it down and making this realistic and possible. So one other piece of legislation we're supporting that I referenced is the Ocean-Based Climate Solutions Act, which is more comprehensive, more detailed, has something related to all those priorities I covered in my intro on the ocean climate action. And to me, that's sort of like the gold standard for ocean and climate and where we need to go. And there's a lot, that needs to be done outside of what Congress can do. And Brad's doing some of that work. It sounds like the private sector is stepping up in some of these areas. And we're seeing the administration come together and really try to coordinate across the government to push these priorities forward.
Great, thanks, Sarah. And Brad, I'll direct this one at you. Sometimes climate goals can leave out the oceans, and I know you were just in Glasgow, and second part is, is the goal of net zero by 2050 a safe place for the oceans? I think from your earlier comments, I think you feel like the answer is no, but what are some ways that climate goals have left out the oceans, and what would you like to see discussions like the one at the COP? What do they still need to be? How can they do a better job of looping in the ocean, the other side of this coin, as you said?
Yeah, well, to refresh people's memories, we got to the Paris Agreement by the intervention of small island developing states who said that 2 degrees was not safe for them and their survival. They now recognize that 1.5 likely isn't either. And in fact, one of the broadcasts from one of the negotiators was him standing in like 3 feet of water. I don't remember which country it was, but the crisis for small island developing states is real. And the answer to your question is 1.5 is not safe for anybody. We're at 1.1 right now. And I don't know about you, it doesn't feel safe to me. It doesn't feel safe anywhere on the planet, and it's only going to get worse. And one of the ways that climate has really overlooked oceans for a long time is that they've not factored in these really devastating positive feedback loops that too much warmth create in the oceans, which lead to more oceans and the cryosphere, which lead to more emissions. So one of the most obvious of those is the loss of Arctic sea ice, which as we lose Arctic ice, the ocean absorbs more heat, the planet warms up rather than reflecting. That's actually responsible for about 30% of all of the heat that we've experienced so far in the biosphere. As permafrost thaws, we see methane. You know, as it warms above the poles, we see forest fires in the boreal forest. None of that has been adequately calculated in what it means to stabilize at 1.5. The bottom line is that 1.5 is political science. It's not science. Science would say we have to go back. And, you know, we have, for safety, we need to move in a different direction. So it's great. 1.5 gives us something to focus on. But as soon as we start making adequate progress, we need to go farther and faster. And carbon removal is one of the most overlooked parts of the discussion in Glasgow and of every COP to date. I think that's going to change. There was a lot more discussion at this meeting of carbon removal. There's a lot more recognition that we have no other choice. We have wasted 40 years really of, while we've just continued to dump ever increasing amounts of carbon, now we have to clean it up. Hopefully that will accelerate. The ocean can play a pretty big role. We need world governments to come together around that to create enabling frameworks for the research and development that's gonna be necessary to do this safely. And we need a lot more investment in these pathways.
All right, thank you, Brad. I'm actually going to switch to some questions that people have been sending me, direct message in the chat. So it's a great way. So I'm going to combine a question from Danielle and one from Dana. Brad, I think you might be best positioned to answer this. What is ocean acidification? And if you can talk about what would be a good policy to reverse it, and sending carbon to the ocean floor, is that permanent, and does it also impact acidification?
So ocean acidification is this chemical process where the ocean, the upper layers of the ocean, absorb carbon from the atmosphere, and it becomes dissolved in the upper layer of the ocean. And through fairly complex ocean chemistry, it changes the pH, which is the sort of measure we use for alkalinity to acidity, towards the more acidic. And that ultimately means that any creatures that form shells have a much harder time forming shells. And there's a lot of zooplankton at the bottom of the food chain that have shell structures. So you've got this enormous change in ocean chemistry that hasn't been seen for millions of years. We've seen a 30% increase towards acidity on the pH scale since the Industrial Revolution. The only way to change that is to add alkalinity back into the system, which will happen over millennia via what's called weathering on land and at sea of alkaline material coming down off the land into the ocean. But that is way too slow for human timeframes. And so the only chance we have, if we want to actually interrupt that process and start to reverse it, is stop the flow of pollution and start to take the carbon out. The ocean stores at the bottom of the sea in bicarbonate form, so not in the dissolved CO2 form, but in a bicarbonate form, about 50 times more carbon than there is in the atmosphere. That is stored very safely, very permanently, on the order of thousands to tens of thousands of years. So it's dangerous in the upper layer of the ocean, and it's much safer when it gets to the deep, deep ocean. And so the trick is essentially mimicking geologic processes and accelerating them through technology. Unfortunately, we put ourselves in a position where natural, just waiting for the problem to solve itself isn't gonna work for humanity. So we need to advance technology to be able to do this and to move carbon from the upper layers down into the deep ocean.
Great, thank you, Brad. I'll direct this next question from Mallory to you, Sarah. Biden talks about offshore wind. How can we pursue these energy creation strategies without negatively impacting marine life?
I think that's a great question and something a lot of states are grappling with now. Much of this comes down to carefully citing these projects and making sure that, there are conversations before these projects go in with community members, with fishermen, with local governments who are going to be impacted by these projects, and making sure that that's a collaborative process to minimize impacts to marine life and to fishing. So I think it does come down to citing.
Can I just add one thought on that? And that is, there's no free lunch here. There's not a single thing we can do to solve the climate problem that won't have some effects. And so what you have to, at the end of the day, do is compare the effect that you might have on marine life in a local area from an offshore wind sighting from the effect of continued carbon-based energy production. And, I think when you do that, then you start to realize that there's going to be trade-offs and choices to be made, but there's no easy path here and no free path.
Great. Thank you both for that. This is a question I think perhaps both of you could comment on from Daniela. What are the kinds of jobs that we might see from carbon removal projects or for Sarah from some of the investments in Build Back Better?
Well, I'll jump in quickly. Carbon removal at the scale that I mentioned, 100 to 1,000 gigatons by the end of the century, so somewhere, around 10 gigatons a year or more, is massive. It's massive, and it will require people. It will require a lot of people to both build and operate, deploy the kinds of operations, whether they be farming seaweed at very large scales, processing it and sinking it, or working on some of these other more technology-based approaches. So coupled with a price for carbon and ultimately a price for negative carbon, which is what we have to get as soon as we get past the price for carbon, we have to actually pay people to remove it. I think it's going to be hopefully a gigantic economic sector, because if it's not, that means we will have failed on carbon removal.
And I think when it comes to ocean and coastal restoration jobs, these jobs are labor intensive. They can't be mechanized, they can't be exported. And they really require a wide variety of skills and experience, and have been shown to stimulate local economies. So I think wide variety of jobs, everything from, boots on the grounds to the more planning projects. So a lot of opportunities there too.
Great, and we're almost at the end of our half hour. I'm feeling acutely just how short that is, but I'll ask one last question and I'll throw this to both of you. How can grassroots advocates like those on this call and in CCL more widely, how can they get involved and help?
So I would say help us lift up the narrative that the climate crisis is an ocean crisis and vice versa. Anytime we're talking about climate, please include the ocean. And on the flip side, know that everything you're doing to advocate for climate solutions is helping the ocean. So help us help people look to the ocean as a source of solutions and innovation.
Yeah, I totally agree with everything Sarah just said. And I would add, hold every politician accountable, hold every elected official everywhere accountable for taking action as if this really were the emergency we all keep saying that it is. Many of us keep using this term, but then we wake up every day and act like it's not an emergency. We have to change that. We have to mobilize like we did for COVID, but about 10 times bigger than that, maybe even 100 times bigger.
All right, Brad, Sarah. Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
Just wanted to chime in on the themes of grit and gratitude here are so important for advocates and definitely make a big difference in ocean advocacy. So one thing I would add in addition to accountability is just thanking your leaders, and not just when they have a good vote, but sort of along the journey. They say something positive in the press, if they have a hearing on this topic, it just really reinforces taking good action when you can show up and say thanks for them.
Speaking of saying thanks, Brad, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us on a Saturday. Really appreciate you lending your time and your experience, your expertise to help educate us. And thank you everybody for joining this session. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.